Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Barbara Morgan, and you're listening to Austin Film Festival's On Story. In this episode, we'll hear from author and screenwriter Gillian Flynn. Gillian is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Gone Girl, for which she wrote the Golden Globe-nominated screenplay, directed by David Fincher, as well as the New York Times bestsellers Dark Places and Sharp Objects. She later adapted and executive produced the Emmy-nominated Sharp Objects for HBO in 2018, which starred Amy Adams and Patricia Clarkson. In that same year, Gillian also co-wrote the screenplay for the heist thriller Widows with director Steve McQueen. Widows stars Viola Davis, Michelle Rodriguez, and Cynthia Erivo. Most recently, she wrote and executive produced the sci-fi drama Utopia for Amazon TV. I spoke with Gillian Flynn at the Austin Film Festival about her creative process of writing across mediums and adapting her own work. Clips of Gone Girl, courtesy of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation and Regency Entertainment. Clips of Sharp Objects, courtesy of Warner Brothers Television and HBO. Clips of Dark Places, courtesy of A24 and Denver and Delilah Films. You started out writing as a journalist and then writing for Entertainment Weekly as a critic. I can't help but wonder how much working as a critic for so many years and watching so much content and analyzing it affected how you wrote your books at first and then how you viewed your television and film. So can you talk about that experience for you?
I started, you know, writing as a staff writer there, so just covering productions of movies and doing profiles, and then switched to the critic role. And I was the TV critic there. It was incredibly helpful because at Entertainment Weekly, you know, you give grades, you know, A, B, C, that sort of thing. And It wasn't talking about the A movies like The Wire. I knew why The Wire worked, or the really awful movies. It was actually what was the most helpful was kind of the C plus TV shows. And looking at them and figuring out why, you know, it's not quite clicking. So what is it?
So your first book, though, was Sharp Objects, right?
That's right.
How did that fit in? Because you were starting to write when you were still at Entertainment Weekly, right? So how did that, when did you start that process of actually writing that book?
I was still a staff writer, so I was still covering productions of movies. So I literally wrote some of it in New Zealand when I was covering The Hobbits, all the Lord of the Rings. And I wrote it, you know, after spending a day with the guys from Jackass while I was covering that. You know, I would write just kind of when I could. Having been a working writer for years at that point, I at least had a name or a product to show people, you know, so it kind of helped me get in the door, I'm sure, being a writer. We went out to publishers. And, you know, you go out, it's sort of like going on speed dating or something. You know, you meet these publishers and kind of see if you're clicking, you know, with the editors. And we got a lot of people who turned us down. And what they said basically was, men don't read books by women, and women don't read books about women that they can't aspire to be. That it was too dark, and women don't like stories about women with problems. They like stories about women overcoming things and ending up, you know, with a happy ending. And my book is the opposite of that. So it did not check any of those boxes. But we did finally we got a publisher, and I'm at Crown.
You end up with this best-selling book. You keep writing. But the first film the first adaptation to a different medium is with Gone Girl, not with your first book.
That's right.
You knock your first book out of the park, right? And then you come in and do a movie with David Fincher. So that's kind of knocking it out of the park again, right? So how did that occur?
That was part of my contract with Fox, was that I would get to write the screenplay. And I wrote the first draft, and, you know, it was good enough that they were sending it out, and Fincher read it and said, let the writer write. And I'm really kind of forever grateful to him, because I would not have the screenwriting career unless he had said that.
Once you then were actually developing it together, you're working with a director. It's your first time, and clearly your first time in this world. So what, you know, you don't even know the rules, and which may be like the greatest thing in the world, right? But how did you two approach that? How did he work with you?
after the process, I kind of said, "I'll, you know, you hear about all these authors who go to Hollywood and have such a horrible time, and you know, it ends up tragically, and you know, they feel awful about the whole experience. And what could be possibly be wrong? Well, they didn't work with David Fincher. You know, David Fincher really helped me refine it. I mean, I remember when I had turned in the first draft to the studio, the one thing I did know, you know, in screenwriting was, you know, you don't turn in anything over 2 hours. It will panic the studio. It has to be 120 pages. And I think I came in literally at 120 pages. And the first thing David said was, "Hey, let's go back in the book and put everything else back in that we want and just see what it ends up at." So we picked different scenes that he wanted back in, which, you know, is a novelist's dream, of course.
To fake a convincing murder, you have to have discipline. You befriend a local idiot. Harvest the details of her humdrum life and cram her with stories about your husband's violent temper. Secretly create some money troubles, credit cards, perhaps online gambling. With the help of the unwitting, bump up your life insurance. Purchase getaway car, Craigslist, generic, cheap, pay cash. You need to package yourself so that people will truly mourn your loss.
These great scenes from the, you know, that I love from the book, going back in, but unfortunately at that point it was about like a mini series. It was, the script was so long, and we knew we had to cut, obviously. And so we, you know, got in there, and he was great about that, you know, knowing when to push me and knowing when to kind of let me have that time and that space. The book came out in May. In August, Fox bought it. I turned in that first draft, you know, right at the beginning of December. And I remember at that point, I was on a massive author tour because the book had, you know, they hadn't necessarily lined stuff up because they didn't think the book was going to sell, but it came in much, much bigger than any of us had thought. So all of a sudden I was doing this author tour. I had a son who was 1 year old. And so I was just, the training from Entertainment Weekly helped me because I knew you don't have to have this sacred space to write. You know, you write where you can. And I remember we started filming, I think, the following year. It went very quickly. You know, that was, I just turned my sole focus to that. And, you know, the film is 2 hours and 37 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it feels that way.
You didn't change the spine of the story at all, but you did clearly have some things that weren't in there, some adjustments you made to things that happened. When you came back with this mini-series script, what were some of the discussions that you had about why certain things now needed to go in service of whatever, you know?
The problem with the adapting that particular book is it's deliberately a piece of clockwork. You know, there's no such thing as pulling out a single thread, because everything kind of affects another thing that's pretty much there for a reason. And so it was hard to, you know, we would think we would have it, you know, like, oh, we'll just remove this scene. And it's like, oh no, we need this scene because it sets up, you know, later on. And people had different ideas. You know, it was like, do you pull out all of Amy's, the fake diary entries? Well, we love the fake, you know, that it's not fun without those. I remember there's a whole plot line in the middle where Amy goes to the Ozarks to hide out for a while and ends up, you know, being the victim of these grifters. And that one doesn't have a huge amount of tied plot to it. And I suggested maybe we remove that. And David was immediately like, we are not removing the Ozarks. Absolutely not. So we cut. I remember, for instance, poor Desi, poor endangered Neil Patrick Harris. When Ben Affleck's character Nick goes to meet him, he has a very odd mother who's sort of floating around the house, and we cut her. You know, she wasn't, you know, that was like, okay, we'll get 3 pages out of there. So it really was of that sort.
I'm thinking about in all of your work, not just your film and television, but in your books, you practice this slow burn, and it's you know, obviously the traditional way to take us to a climax, but obviously that climax is never the climax. And then there's another climax, you know. And so you just have a very non-traditional story structure, but you've applied it to film and television. I'd love to hear your thinking about applying that to that medium in particular. And, you know, you brought up how twisty you are. That's a, you know, big, clearly a big part of your writing. Can you talk about, you know, why your feelings about knowing that's going to work?
I never write anything where I know how it's going to end. So Sharp Objects, I just knew I wanted that bump at the end. And it was that decision of, if you're going to have a big surprise at the end, you know, how long or short does it need to be so that the reader or the audience doesn't go, oh, obviously a twist is coming, you know, because you've gone in now. So we've been watching this for 10 minutes. They're setting up something. So it was that very like delicate timing of how quickly you do it. So it works. And with Gone Girl, I mean, deciding on doing a twist right in the middle of the book did not feel entirely right. I definitely wasn't sure about it. So I had originally written it where it was the first half was all from Nick's point of view. Then you find out and then they start alternating points of view. But I remember my editor saying, so I just want you to know, so you've written a book where you have two main characters who really aren't that likable. And it's a whodunit where you find out whodunit in the middle, and it has an ending that is not, you know, about justice. I mean, there's not just desserts at the end. I just feel like, as far as the slow burn goes, I just like a slow burn because I like to get to know my characters and, you know, get to know the place. And I do know that it's an impatient world and people have many options, and there's that, you know, with that risk that they will just turn to something else if there's not a big kabang immediately. But for me, you know, I don't write for hire. You know, I write because I love it. Even if someone told me your stuff isn't going to sell, for, you know, as well before, unless you write something that's more mainstream. And just what interests me, I would say I'll just take the smaller audience.
You move on to Sharp Objects, doing 8 episodes, which is a tremendous amount of real estate to be able to explore this first book of yours, right? One of the things that I loved about you taking that into the 8 episodes is that it was just a way to really thoughtfully absorb what's happening to this woman, you know, where you sort of felt like she doesn't even know what she's coming back to here. And she's trying to analyze her own life and desperately needs to do that. And you've thrown her into the pit of hell in a way. But we get to really experience that, which I feel like was a really great way to tell that story, better than just a 2-hour film. So can you talk about how you and Marty got to the decision to do it this way and choose 8? And
Marty came and had this great idea. And we had Amy on board, who I absolutely adore, and we went and around town and pitched it, and HBO liked it and gave us that space of 8 episodes, which I just think it was one that you really, in order to not feel exploitative, because it does go to very, very dark places, that it needed that time so that you could understand Camille, the main character, Amy's character, and feel for her and understand that pain that she was in all the time, that emotional pain, and to understand her as a character and understand the place, you know, that way you get to know where she grew up, which obviously contributed along with her mother to who she is. And I've always, I think in everything I write, almost you go back to the, you know, one of the main characters or all the main characters' childhoods, you know, if it's not a full flashback, it's certainly memories throughout, because I really believe that if you understand where someone came from, it's very hard to judge them.
This funeral is going to be very hard. You'll love those girls.
How did you know those girls again?
Camille, I'm very involved in the community. It's our family's duty.
Oh,
four dead little girls as if Marion wasn't enough.
Are you friends with Natalie?
Enough to be sad, too, which is why I should go.
You're going to stay here with Gayla and have ice cream. Mm-hmm. I want to know where you are. Camille, maybe you should stay back, too, given your state of mind.
You know, the more you know about why someone is the way they are, the more you can at least empathize. And so I can write very dark characters. And, you know, I'm always known as like the dark female character writer. But it's important so that it doesn't feel cheap or done for shock value, that if you understand why that person is the way they are, they feel like a real person. I was glad to have that space to be able to fully explore who this person is. We had a great team, about six writers. They were so faithful to the book that I had to actually, at one point I was like, hey guys, like it's becoming a movie. It has to become something else. So you don't need to feel like just because I'm here, like let's cut some stuff. Let's get in there, cut what's not working. Let's rearrange and add where we want to. So, you know, to me, that was a key kind of moment. It's like, I am not going to be precious. You know, I came from the world of journalism, which is, you know, kill your babies. Like, let's get in there and make this a proper TV series. And the episode I felt most strongly about was episode 7. So, you know, the penultimate episode. And because it was, to me, that was when everything about Camille clicked, and the scene with her and the young guy finally together. He's in deep mourning. She's been in mourning for, you know, most of her life for her sister. And, you know, when she undresses and, you know, and he starts looking at the words, and he's so gentle with her. And, you know, she says, "You're reading me," in this, you know, Amy Adams' wonderful voice.
Is it everywhere? Drained. Cherry. Sick. Gone.
You read me.
Wrong.
So that one was the one I was, I think, the most worried about. Again, it's that sort of, I think we deliberately made, at one point wrote in that he was 18 because we didn't want to make Camille a felon. but you know, it wasn't supposed to feel sexy in any way. It wasn't supposed to, you know, it wasn't supposed to be titillating. It was supposed to be this sigh of relief of a woman who finds someone who understands her and is not for once judging her. And that sensation. So, you know, to me, that was really important to write that particular episode.
Do you ever feel this way about your source material, that now that you're in a different medium, you have a chance to be, you have a chance to look back at what you wrote and maybe change it, alter it in some way, or, you know, even if it's little ways?
Oh, sure. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. And I can think of one example, actually, which is with Gone Girl. There's a speech that has been called now the cool girl speech, that if you type in cool girl speech, you know, on Google, it'll come up for you immediately. And, you know, it just has a sort of phrase that has gotten adopted. And it's a sort of about Amy, the main character, railing against the expectations of men, basically, and very specifically.
Nick and Amy will be gone, but then we never really existed. Nick loved a girl I was pretending to be. Cool girl. Men always use that, don't they, as their defining compliment. She's a cool girl. Cool girl is hot. Cool girl is game. Cool girl is fun. Cool girl never gets angry at her man. She only smiles in a chagrin, loving manner, and then presents her mouth for. She likes what he likes. So evidently, he's a vinyl hipster who loves fetish manga. If he likes girls gone wild, she's a mall babe who talks football and endures buffalo wings at Hooters. When I met Nick Dunn, I knew he wanted Cool Girl. And for him, I'll admit, I was willing to try.
You know, that one had come up. I was always getting that question about the Cool Girl speech at any event that I did. And I didn't include it originally in the script because I just couldn't figure out where it possibly went and where we would hear it. We can't hear it until Amy Midpoint is revealed as a villain because she's someone else before that. So then you're at the stage where you're kind of racing with the plot. And, you know, it's like, where do I possibly insert this while all these plot points have to happen now and without slowing it down? And then finally came up with the idea of her saying it as she's very first escaping. So it's kind of a very early monologue, voiceover from her as she's disappearing herself. So she's talking about women and kind of altering themselves for men. And she's, you know, dyeing her hair and eating food to gain, she's trying to gain weight. She's just trying to change her body any way it can. So that was one where it didn't necessarily have to be there, but we wanted it there. And so kind of finding a way to get it in there.
Your characters, especially your female ones, are so complex. What's the secret to making us root for some of them?
To me, again, like a lot of it comes down, most of my characters have a sense of humor and a self-awareness. And I think people can respond to that, you know, if you at least know you're a jerk. That's maybe the first step and can be kind of funny about it, I think helps. I think also, you know, again, going back to that idea of knowing people's childhood, you know what they've gone through. You know what they've dealt with. So you do, you know, I think that empathy grows if you understand that.
I'm going to jump to Widows, which you now have gone into adapting someone else's work, right? So that's a really interesting project to me because you took it the opposite way from a British television show to a film. So you're essentially having to boil it down to the essence, right, as the adaptation. Can you talk about how that process worked with you and Steve McQueen in comparison to, for instance, Gone Girl, where you were going from your own work?
Widows, the TV series by Linda LaPlante, is amazing. It's so good. And so I was immediately hooked. And, you know, then you ask the question, is this adaptable? You know, can we turn it into a 2-hour film, and if so, what is there to be done with it that it makes it worth redoing? You know, I've always said, you know, just because something's great doesn't mean you should remake it. You know, you need to remake it for a reason. And, you know, so we really explored, you know, the kind of, we wanted to make it current day, but without all current day gadgetry. Like, that was one of our main things, was that we thought it felt like at its heart, it was kind of a hard-boiled 70s show, actually, as far as the procedural cop stuff and the heist went. You know, I kind of crossed my arms at the idea of doing a heist film. I'm not a heist film person. What I thought was we could say something, you know, it was about women who'd lost their husbands and find a clue and are able to pull off a heist and kind of get the bad guys who were involved with their husband's death.
Something happened tonight, something bad. Our husbands aren't coming back. We're on our own. They stole a lot of money. And now people want it from us. The best thing we have going for us is being who we are.
Why?
Because no one thinks we have the to pull this off.
To me, I thought there was a lot to say right now, you know, about power imbalance, about gender, about race, that idea of how stacked and unfair life can be, and to really kind of keep that always in mind as we were doing it, that this would be more than a heist film. You know, it had to do, we wanted to see each of these women in their different circumstances.
You seem to be attracted to telling us stories about people who are cruel to each other. They're cruel, particularly to their family. I mean, certainly there's lots of material, great material to explore there. But I mean, do you enjoy that sort of exploration of I don't know, psychopathy.
When you're reading or watching something about a horrible murder, you know, you are consuming someone else's tragedy. You know, mm-hmm. That tragedy has been produced for viewing or reading and packaged. And so I have conflicting feelings about that, but it doesn't stop me. I just try to watch the good stuff, I guess, mm-hmm. because I think the reason people are so intrigued by true crime is it gives us this vocabulary to talk about darkness. You know, I think women deal with so much psychologically every day. Every day, women are dealing with that idea that something really bad could happen to me. You know, I should go in this garage alone. I shouldn't do this. This bad thing could happen. And so I think true crime, why particularly a lot of women are just, it is that idea of living in a society where it's accepted that, you know, a lot of women get raped every day. A lot of pregnant women are murdered by their partners, you know, that we accept those statistics as if that's okay, as if it's a disease that we can't possibly prevent. So I think it gives us a way to talk about that. And so that's always translated into my work, that idea of close quarters cruelty, I guess. Yeah. That what's behind the door and what's really happening. And again, going back to, you know, family and how you grew up, and, you know, certainly Dark Places, which is possibly my favorite book that I wrote, is a lot about childhood and things that happened in childhood and how they can ripple forever through your life.
I know you killed them.
No, I did not.
It's not what you said back then.
Of course not. I was a teenage boy in a house full of girls. At school, I was the kid nobody paid attention to. In that courtroom, people were scared of me. I was
killed his family.
Libby, I was a fool, but I did not kill Mom or Debbie or Michelle.
Then why have you never filed for an appeal? You like it so much in there, you want to stay there? You know what I think? I think you're full of
the things that intrigue me are the psychology behind violence and why it happens, and sometimes why, you know, Dark Places is certainly about in part, you know, event that never would have happened unless certain people and events came together all at the same time. You know, mm-hmm. I've always been kind of fascinated by that.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and the National Endowment for the Arts, on the web at arts.gov. On Story is supported in part by Too Far Media, immersive story experiences by Rich Shapiro. This show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Jamal Knox and Colin Heyer. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from SoundLab, Inc., Travis Kennedy Sound, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.